This is Mary Rose Cottingham returning with the Decatur and Herald Review from Monday, May 23, 2016. We continue now with the death notices. Danny R. Gregg, 59, of Charleston, died Saturday, May 21, 2016. Services are 10 a.m. Wednesday at the United Pentecostal Tabernacle Church in Charleston. Visitation is 5 to 8 p.m. Tuesday in the church. Burial Beecher City Cemetery, and arrangements are by the Lockhart Green Funeral Home of Shelbyville. The Reverend Cletus Otto Hicks, age 73, of Shelbyville, died on Saturday, May 21, 2016, at Shelby Memorial Hospital. Visitation will be Wednesday, May 25, from 5 to 7 p.m., with funeral services Thursday, May 26, at 11 a.m., all at the Lockhart Green Funeral Home in Shelbyville. Burial will be in Glenwood Cemetery. Memorials may be made to the House of Expectancy Full Gospel Church, Shelbyville. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.lockhartgreenfuneralhome.com. Elise Elizabeth Heiser, age 96, of Columbus, Ohio, formerly of Decatur, passed away on Thursday, May 19, 2016, at Columbus Care Center. Funeral services will be held at 1 p.m. Wednesday, May 25th, at Brinklinger and Earl Funeral Home, Decatur. Burial will be at the Graceland Cemetery in Decatur. Condolences may be left to the family in care of Brinklinger and Earl Funeral Home at www.brinklingerandearl.com. William Dale Ward, age 86, of Sullivan, passed away at 10:51 p.m. Saturday, May 21st, at St. Mary's Hospital in Decatur. Memorial services will be held at 11 a.m. Wednesday, May 25th, at First Christian Church in Sullivan. Visitation will be held 1 hour before the services at the First Christian Church, Sullivan. Interment will be in Green Hill Cemetery, Sullivan, at a later date. Arrangements were made by the McMullen Young Funeral Home in Sullivan, and memorials may be made to the First Christian Church in Sullivan. Zola Louise Daniels, age 81, of Monticello, passed away at 5:22 p.m. on Thursday, May 19th, at the Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana, Illinois. Celebration of life services will be held at a later date. Private family burial will be held in the Bement Township Cemetery. Per her wishes, cremation rites have been accorded. Aaron and Susie Hines at the Hines Funeral Home in Bement, Illinois, are serving the family of Zola L. Daniels. Raymond Lee Ferry, Jr., age 83, formerly of Decatur, Illinois, died on May 15, 2016, at 9:15 a.m. in Greenville, Kentucky. Memorial services will be conducted on Saturday, June 11, at 2 p.m. at Holy Cross Lutheran Church, 3778 North Water Street, Decatur, with visitation preceding the service from 1 to 2 p.m. In lieu of flowers, contributions can be made to Camp Hope Vanderbilt Burn Center, Vanderbilt Donor Services, 2525 West End Avenue, Suite 450, Nashville, Tennessee, 37203, or to the Salvation Army in Decatur at 229 West Main Street, in Decatur, 62525. Online condolences can be made at www.caringbridge.org/visit/Raymond Ferry. Carol Robert Koch, age 83, of Decatur, passed away on Friday, May 20, 2016, at Fair Havens Christian Home after a long battle with MS. Funeral services will be 10 a.m. Wednesday, May 25th, at Northwest Christian Church, Decatur, with visitation from 5 to 8 p.m. Tuesday, May 24th, at the church. Burial will be in Graceland Cemetery, Decatur. Brittlinger and Earl Funeral Homes are assisting the family with the arrangements. Memorials may be made to the Northwest Christian Church or Fair Havens Christian Home. Lois E. Owens, age 89, of Decatur, passed away on April 19, 2016, in Decatur Memorial Hospital. Memorial services will be Friday, May 27, at 7 p.m. at Antioch Christian Church, 5409 U.S. 36, in Decatur, 62521. Visitation will be 1 hour before the service at the church. The Tanzius Logan Funeral Service and Care is assisting with the arrangements. Mary Ellen Peel, age 96, of Decatur, passed away at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, May 19th, in McKinley Court Care Center. The Mass of Christian Burial will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, May 26th, at St. Thomas Catholic Church, with visitation 1 hour prior to the service at the church. Burial will be at Graceland Cemetery, Decatur. Britlinger and Earl Funeral Homes are assisting the family with the arrangements, and memorials may be made to the St. Thomas Catholic Church. Reverend Father Paul Henry Skelton passed away peacefully on Friday, May 20th at 1:43 a.m. at the Tuscola Healthcare Center in Tuscola, Illinois. A Mass of Christian Burial for Father Skelton will be celebrated on Tuesday, May 24th at 10:30 a.m. at Sacred Heart Church in Villa Grove, with the Most Reverend Thomas John Paprocki, Bishop of Springfield, presiding. Burial will take place at the Oakland Cemetery in Oakland, Illinois. Visitation for Father Skelton will be held at Sacred Heart Church in Villa Grove on Sunday, May 22nd, from 1 to 5 p.m., with a prayer service at 1 p.m. On Monday, May 23rd, from 4 p.m. until 8 p.m., with a recitation of the Rosary at 4 p.m., and on Tuesday, May 24th, from 9 a.m. until 10:30 a.m. before the funeral mass. Memorials may be made to Sacred Heart Church in Villa Grove. Father Skelton's funeral arrangements are being handled by the Joins Funeral Home, 1375 North State Route 130, Villa Grove, Illinois, 217-832-8322. Martha Marlene Stalter passed away on May 11, 2016. Martha Marlene J. was born in Atwood, Illinois, on November 16, 1934. In lieu of flowers, donations can be made to the First Baptist Church of Atwood or the American Cancer Society. A private graveside service was held at Mackville Cemetery in Atwood, Illinois on May 21st. Lloyd Carlin Tripp, age 89, of Decatur, passed away Monday, May 16th at home. There will be no public services. Tanzius Logan Funeral Service and Care is assisting the family. Sign the guest book at www.tlcelebratingeverylife.com. Frances Rebecca Van Hall, age 98, of Sun City, Arizona, passed away Sunday, May 15th in Legends Senior Living in Peoria, Arizona. Honoring her wishes, a private family graveside service is planned. Dawson and Wyckoff North Chapel is assisting the family with services. Memorials may be made to the Central Christian Church or a charity of the donor's choice. Messages of condolence may be sent to the family at www.dawson-wyckoff.com. Carmela Marie Beasley, aged 47, of Decatur, died on May 19th at St. Mary's Hospital. Services will be held at 12 noon on Tuesday, May 24th, at New Life Church of God, with visitation 1 hour before the service. The burial will be at Greenwood Cemetery. Professional services are entrusted to Walker Funeral Service, www.walkerfs.com. Celia Marguerite Brown, age 96, of Blue Mound, Illinois, died on Thursday, May 19, 2016. Messages of condolence may be sent to the family at www.dawson-wyckoff.com. Memorial service to celebrate Marguerite's life will be held at 11 a.m. Monday, May 23rd, at Dawson and Wyckoff Funeral Home, Blue Mound, with Pastor Randy Myers officiating. The family will receive friends for time of visitation 1 hour prior to the service on Monday. In lieu of flowers, the family suggests that donations be made to the Blue Mound United Methodist Church or the Blue Mound Order of the Eastern Star. Tilly L. Small Burnett, age 77, of Springfield, passed away on Wednesday, May 18th, at Regency Nursing Home. The visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. on Sunday, May 22nd, at Curlin Egan and Butler Funeral Home, 900 South 6th Street in Springfield. Funeral ceremony will be 10 a.m. on Monday, May 23rd, at Curlin Egan and Butler Funeral Home, with Pastor Brooks Wilson officiating. Burial will follow at Rose Lawn Memorial Park. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made to the American Cancer Society, 675 East Linton, Springfield, Illinois, 62703. Please visit butlerfuneralhomes.com to offer your condolences. Nancy Carol Hammond, age 81, of Decatur, passed away Thursday, May 19th, at her home. Funeral services to celebrate the life of Nancy Carol Hammond will be 11 a.m. Tuesday, May 24th, 2016, at Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Visitation will be from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. Tuesday before the service at the funeral home. Burial will be in Graceland Cemetery. Memorials may be directed to the Decatur Memorial Hospice. The family of Nancy Carol Hammond is being served by the Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home, 2091 North Oakland Avenue, Decatur. Send condolences to the family at www.gracelandfairlawn.com. Barbara June Miner, age 78, of Sullivan, passed away on Friday, May 20th, at St. Mary's Hospital in Decatur. Funeral services will be held 10:30 a.m. Monday, May 23rd, at McMullen Young Funeral Home in Sullivan. Visitation will be held from 3 to 5 p.m. Sunday, May 22nd, at McMullen Young Funeral Home in Sullivan. Burial will be in French Cemetery, Allenville. Memorials may be made to the donor's choice. Donald Dale Ruff, age 85, of Strasburg, Illinois, died at 6:55 p.m. Thursday, May 19th, in St. Anthony's Memorial Hospital in Effingham, Illinois. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Tuesday, May 24th, in St. Paul's Lutheran Church, Strasburg, with Reverend Stephen Becker officiating. Visitation will be from 9:30 to 11 a.m. Tuesday in the church. Burial will be in St. Paul's Cemetery, Strasburg. Memorials may be given to the St. Paul's Lutheran Church, Strasburg, Illinois, or Trinity Lutheran School, Stewartson, Illinois. Arrangements are by Howe and Yockey Funeral Home in Strasburg. Please send condolences to www.howeandyockey.com. Sharon Stokes, age 70, of Mauquia, died May 19th in Mauquia Rehabilitation and Health Care Center. Graveside services will be 10:30 a.m. Monday, May 23rd, in Oddfellow Cemetery, Mauquia, Illinois. Memorials may be made to the Mauquia Ambulance Service or to St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. Site's funeral home, Mauquia, has been entrusted with the care and service arrangements. Condolences for the family may be left at www.seitzfh.com. That ends the death notices for Monday, May 23rd. We now move to the opinion page of the Decatur Herald Review. Here's the editorial. The headline is, How to Shorten Airport Lines. Not long ago, the Department of Homeland Security went undercover at airports to check for vulnerabilities in the passenger screening process. The conclusions were scary. Failures of technology, of procedure, and human error at the Transportation Security Administration. We found layers of security simply missing, said John Roth, the department's inspector general. Paul Neffinger, who took the top job at TSA last year, blamed harried security officers trying to keep wait lines manageable. People were pushed through the checkpoint, he said. And there you have crucial background to the agony at airports around the country, where getting through security can take 60 to 90 minutes, causing some travelers to miss flights. It doesn't take much reading between the lines, forgive us, to figure that TSA's potentially dangerous screw-ups, plus a new administrator who wants to keep his job, means more methodical screenings and longer security lines. Of course, we all want airport security. The country is counting on TSA to protect travelers from another terrorist assault. Security appeared to tighten after the bloodbath in Brussels. We get it. But that does not mean travelers should have to put up with the frustrations of interminable, unpredictable lines. The airlines, which appear as infuriated as passengers, can't keep asking passengers to turn up earlier and earlier at the airport. Arrive 3 or 4 hours before takeoff? No. Back to basics. TSA has two primary jobs: keep transportation safe and run an efficient, professional operation. Americans expect both to be done right. If Homeland Security's undercover operations lit a fire under Neffinger to be diligent about security, we trust he's also feeling the heat to fix management of the screening process. Senator Mark Kirk, Republican from Illinois, told Neffinger he should get passenger lines going again at Chicago's airports by Memorial Day or resign. We're not inclined to set a deadline, but the holiday weekend represents the unofficial start to the summer travel season. So unless operations start to improve soon, lines are about to get even longer. Some quick fixes were thrown at O'Hare and Midway this week, specifically the promise of more screening staff on duty and more bomb-sniffing canine teams, which can expedite part of the screening process. But the problems bedeviling TSA are much broader in scope, involving the entire air travel system. A slightly faster line at O'Hare doesn't help passengers stranded in Newark or Atlanta. Start with the fact that, according to its union, TSA has about 42,000 officers, down from 47,000 in 2013. That might constitute a responsible budgeting, except passenger traffic is up by about 15%. At least part of this mismatch was supposed to be covered by the introduction of the Trusted Traveler programs. Flyers who sign up for TSA's pre-check are vetted ahead of time and then whisked through a separate, faster line. It's a time saver for frequent travelers, but the program is underused. The hassle of signing up plus the $85 fee for 5 years evidently has dissuaded people, thus the airport lines. Because TSA runs security, a lot of the responsibility to get the lines moving rests with Neffinger and his management team. But from where we sit at, toward the back of the plane, bags stowed overhead, all parties can make contributions. Airlines. If you're assigning staff to help passengers traverse the long lines, please keep it up. But you're also playing an unintended role by charging fees for checked baggage. That compels passengers to bring more carry-on stuff, which gums up the screening process. Consider relaxing your baggage fee rules to coax more flyers to check baggage, and thus reduce carry-ons going through security, if only for the summer. This kind of deed will be remembered. We wonder how much more quickly the inspections could move if airlines flipped their incentives, charging for carry-on baggage, but letting checked bags fly free. Problem solved. Passengers. If you fly regularly, join pre-check. You will get through security more quickly with your sanity intact. Then the obvious. Pack light, don't be late, follow instructions to get through the checkpoints smoothly. Finally, our advice to the TSA. Make the right calls on staffing and ensure officers are thorough, efficient, and professional. We hear your calls for patience and for arriving plenty early at the airport. But, Mr. Meffinger, we expect you to lead the charge on this. If there are glitches in the system, fix them. Congress appropriated money for hiring and overtime this month. If you need additional funds, make the case. Americans have places to be. Do not leave us hanging. Our next article is headlined, Former Clinton Aide Blumenthal, Now Lincoln Biographer. Before Sidney Blumenthal was a White House aide and confidant of Bill and Hillary Clinton, before he was a journalist for The New Yorker and The Washington Post and author of the influential political book, The Permanent Campaign, he was a boy in Chicago mesmerized by the story of Abraham Lincoln. "I've always been fixated on Lincoln," the 67-year-old Blumenthal said. He recalled a childhood trip to visit Lincoln landmarks in Springfield, the sense of immediacy from the old state capitol, and the reconstruction of the village of New Salem. "It had a profound effect on me," he said. The mountain of Lincoln books has grown taller with publication of A Self-Made Man, The Political Life of Abraham Lincoln, 1809-1849, the first of four planned volumes on the 16th president. More than 500 pages long, A Self-Made Man follows Lincoln's story and the politics of the country from his birth in 1809 through the completion of his one term as a congressman in 1849. The next installments, which Blumenthal has mostly completed, are scheduled to come out in each of the following 3 years. The question for Blumenthal, for any new Lincoln author, is what he can add to the writings of David Herbert Donald, Doris Kearns Goodwin, Michael Burlingame, Harold Holzer, and so many others. Blumenthal's credentials stem from his own background, a reporter's instincts for uncovering news, a political obsessive's immersion in history, and, through his time in the Clinton White House, first-hand knowledge of how the presidency works. "American politics is very real to me. It's very palpable. It's something I can feel and touch," he says. It's my experience, and has been my experience since I was a boy. Nearly a decade in the making, Blumenthal's book arrives with blurbs from such top Lincoln and Civil War scholars as Holzer and James McPherson, and favorable early reviews from Kirkus and other publications. Gene Weilentz, the Princeton University professor and prize-winning historian, is a longtime friend who read early drafts of his Lincoln series. He said that two qualities stood out. First, Weilentz said, Sid understands, as few if any professional historians ever have, the inner workings of American politics at every level and in all their aspects, and with all their flaws, he respects them. Second, Sid uses his skills as a shoe-leather reporter to track down leads and unravel important stories that previous writers have either slighted, ignored, or misunderstood. Not easy to do in the most written-about figure in all of American history. Blumenthal writes about Lincoln's deep and personal hatred of slavery. I used to be a slave, Lincoln would recall of his father's renting him out as a laborer. He dissents from a popular interpretation of Lincoln's first major public speech, the so-called Lyceum address in Springfield in 1838. Delivered soon after a jury had acquitted the leader of a mob that murdered the abolitionist Elijah Lovejoy, the address was a plea for reason and the rule of law that featured a widely cited passage. This is a quote from Lincoln. Towering genius disdains a beaten path. It seeks regions hitherto unexplored. It sees no distinction in adding story to story upon the monuments of fame erected to the memory of others. It denies that it is glory enough to serve under any chief. It scorns to tread in the footsteps of any predecessor, however illustrious. It thirsts and burns for distinction. End quote. The critic Edmund Wilson was among those who perceived the speech as an unconscious prophecy of Lincoln's own rise. But Blumenthal, drawing upon documents and the scholarship of Burlingame, among others, sees it as directed against a fellow Illinois politician who became his longtime rival, Stephen A. Douglas. It's a brilliant idea on Wilson's part, but it is a myth, he says. Lincoln speaks against mob violence and talks about at length that the United States will never face an external threat that could end our democracy. The greatest threat comes from within, from this kind of trampling of the rule of law, and especially through the incitement of mobs and violence. His years with the Clintons inform his Lincoln books, but might also distract from them. Lincoln scholar Alan Guzzo, in a review for the Washington Monthly, praised A Self-Made Man as a great book, but also noted Blumenthal's well-publicized history. The one-time tiger of the Clinton administration, notably during the Monica Lewinsky scandal, who went on to advise Hillary Clinton during her 2008 candidacy and became a paid consultant for the Clinton Foundation. Most recently, Blumenthal was a target of the Republican-led congressional investigation into the killings at the U.S. diplomatic compound in Benghazi, Libya, in 2012, when Clinton was Secretary of State. Blumenthal testified in a closed session last June, and his name was cited prominently during Hillary Clinton's televised appearance in October. The questions focused on the dozens of emails she received from her friend. Before one break in testimony, the committee chair, Representative Trey Gowdy of South Carolina, warned, "If you think we've heard about Sidney Blumenthal, wait for the next round." Blumenthal, who has no formal role in Clinton's current campaign, said he had always called for the release of my deposition before the Benghazi committee, and from the second I stepped out of that room. I testified for 9.5 hours. I answered every question. And if and when ever that deposition is made public, you'll see I did talk about this book. Our next article is headlined, Cotton Gins Decreasing in Arkansas. Cotton gins are disappearing as Arkansas farmers abandon cotton for more profitable crops. The number of gins in the state has fallen from 86 to 26 in the past 15 years, the Arkansas Democrat Gazette reported on Sunday. 9 gins closed in Arkansas in 2014 alone, according to the National Agricultural Statistics Service. The upkeep is expensive, said Terry Holland, a farmer who has grown cotton for about 30 years, and many gin owners found it wasn't worth it to modernize the needed infrastructure and implements. This year, an estimated 9.56 million acres of cotton was to be planted in the U.S., 11% more than last year, according to data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. But Arkansas's acreage has slipped significantly. About 1 million acres of cotton were planted in Arkansas in 2000, but has fallen to a projected $330,000 acres for 2016, the USDA said. The state's cotton industry has never seen an extended period of acreage reduction quite like we've seen since 2000, said Scott Stiles, extension economist for the University of Arkansas Systems Agriculture Division. Holland said he can recall a time when there were 15 to 16 cotton gins in eastern Clay County. Now there's one, Holland said. Farmers now plant crops that can boost their bottom lines, such as soybeans, in the fields that once grew cotton. We saw the prices go up in other commodities, said Nathan Reed, a row crop farmer in the Arkansas Delta, not so in cotton. Cotton is expensive to grow, Reed said. The equipment and infrastructure is specialized, and that can require a lot of money up front. A cotton picker will cost a farmer around $700,000, he said. Unlike combines that can be used for various types of crops, cotton pickers are only used for cotton production. It takes a whole different set of machinery to grow cotton, Reed said. A lot of farmers sold their old pickers and did not make the investment in a new one. Reed said it takes about 2,000 acres of cotton to make the investment profitable. Another article headlined, Medicare Covers End-of-Life Talk, from Hackensack, New Jersey. The doctor got right down to business after Herbert Diamond bounded in. A single green form before her, she had some questions for the agile 88-year-old about comas and ventilators, about feeding tubes and CPR, about intense and irreversible suffering. You want treatments as long as you are going to have a good quality of life? Dr. Manisha Perluka asked. The retired accountant nodded. And at that point, she continued, you would like to focus more on comfort, right? There was no hesitation before his soft-spoken reply, right. Scenes like this have been spreading across the U.S. in the months since Medicare started paying for conversations on end-of-life planning. 7 years after that very idea spurred fears of death panels, supporters hope lingering doubts will fade. The more and more that happens, the more patients, families, and doctors will become comfortable with it, said Dr. Joe Rotella, Chief Medical Officer of the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine. Any distrust people have about what is this really disappears when patients sit down and find out that this is about empowering them. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services quietly tucked the change, allowing for payments for end-of-life counseling into a massive package of regulations last summer, with billing permissible as of January 1st. To date, CMS has not released any data on how many people have taken part in the sessions, but a survey released last month suggests it may be off to a slow start. Three nonprofits, the California Health Care Foundation, Columbia Health Foundation, and the John A. Hartford Foundation, fielded a poll of 736 doctors who see patients 65 years and older. Only 14% said they have already billed Medicare for the new counseling, although the survey was conducted February 18th through March 7th, meaning the earliest participants had only had about 6 weeks from the start of the benefit. Altogether, 95% of doctors in the poll expressed support for the Medicare benefit, and a big majority considered such conversations important. Some doctors had already incorporated end-of-life planning into regular visits, and certain private insurers began offering reimbursement for it before Medicare announced its change. But because Medicare is the single largest payer of health care in the U.S., this could stand to be one of the most significant developments in end-of-life care ever seen in the country. It also gives Americans a glimpse into something many only knew through the lens of controversy.